Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with Security Shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
This episode is brought to you by Intuit, the technology platform that brings financial confidence with products like TurboTax, Credit Karma, QuickBooks, and MailChimp. You might have learned the recorder in school, but probably not how to navigate the financial world. Luckily, Intuit's on a mission to help with the free Intuit for Education program. It provides students with the lessons to learn essential skills, like how to build credit, file taxes, and budget. Check out their free resources at intuit.com/education.
Your teen requested a ride, but this time not from you. It's through their Uber teen account. You drive your teenager around a lot to their friend Jacob's house, their other friend Jake's house, to James's, to Jaden's, to Jalen's, to...
Mom, this is Jake's house, not Jacob's.
Now with an Uber teen account, your teen can request a ride under your supervision. They'll ride with a highly rated driver, and with live trip tracking, you'll follow along the whole ride to their friends' houses that all sound the same. Add your teen to your Uber account today. See app for details.
Bye, Mom.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in the Performing Arts, a podcast series on the New Books Network. I am your host, Pete Kunze. My guest today is David Saverin, professor emeritus in theater and performance at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York and author of Tell It to the World, The Broadway Musical Abroad. The book was published by Oxford University Press in 2024. Good morning, David, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks, Pete. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, I'm honored to be able to speak with you about this project, which I think is super interesting and exciting. To begin with, can you tell us a bit about your background and your research interests?
Well, I just retired, actually, and from the theater and performance program. It's a doctoral program, and I started at CUNY in 2021. I'm sorry, in 2001. And I had been teaching before that at Brown in the English department. And I was very happy to move from English to theater and performance. And all of my recent work has been about performance, really, like this book.
So what brought you to this project in particular? What inspired Tell It to the World?
Well, I started working on musical theater in the 1990s when I was at Brown. Rose Subotnick was then teaching in the music department, who is a sort of very highly respected music theorist, but she also loves Broadway musicals and was teaching Broadway musicals. And so we twice co-taught classes on musical theater, and I learned so much from Rose. And I was writing about musical theater quite seriously in the late 90s, early 2000s, sort of just as the field of musical theater studies was becoming legitimized, and which was very exciting for me. And I really like traveling, and I was spending a lot of time in Germany and going to the theater there and seeing American musicals. I mean, I think probably the first big one I saw was the Kiss Me Kate in 2008, Barry Kosky's, about which I write. And then there was a couple of years later was a production of Lady in the Dark, which I completely adore. And, you know, to see these musicals given huge productions, you know, in opera houses. So in other words, with a 30 or 40 piece orchestra and a mixture of opera singers and actors, I was dazzled. I could not believe it. And About the same time, I had a Korean student who was doing research on Korean musicals and was writing about a Korean production of Dreamgirls. And I was fascinated. I thought, how do they do Dreamgirls without blackface? You know, how did they do it basically without references to race and specifically to African American history and culture? So it took me a while to find out, and Kayla helped me enormously in this. And then I saw a Korean musical here that toured to New York in 2011, about which I write Hero. And I was blown away by that. And so from these, I came to realize that Koreans are really, really expert at doing American musicals. And as far as I'm concerned, actually, to be honest, I think Korean singers and musicians are better than Germans. Germans, there are various affectations that a lot of German singers have that Koreans do not. And so it's been a thrill for me to discover not so much how they do American musicals, but how they've incorporated the form and the conventions, the vernacular, if you will, of American musicals into their own music theater. That, for me, has really been at the heart of this project and what I love most about this work.
Yeah, I think there's sometimes a misconception by folks who don't work on Broadway that Broadway is somehow restricted to a small area of New York, right? When really it becomes this launching pad. And as you've talked about in your work, the way it becomes a brand. And one of the points you make at the outset here is how mobile the Broadway musical is. And I think for some listeners and readers, they may think too of Stacey Wolf's book on how the Broadway musical, how it travels across the U.S. And your book offers us a deep dive into particularly the German context and the South Korean context, as you mentioned. Can you talk a bit more about how those contexts really enrich the way that we've thought about musical theater, especially in the Academy?
The study of musicals abroad is really pretty new. And when I started the project around 2012, there was virtually nothing. But in fact, English-speaking musical theater scholars have sprouted basically all over the world. So this is a kind of nascent industry. A couple of years ago, the Routledge Companion to Musical Theater was published. And that is the first and only attempt, really, to survey musicals on a global scale. And what we're talking about here, it's not, you know, we're not talking about the specifics of the Lion King tour or Phantom of the Opera. I mean, yeah, that's a part of the story. But again, the most important part is how these have been adapted, how they've been changed. I mean, the Lion King in Shanghai is not the same as the Lion King in New York or in Hamburg or in London. And studying the circulation of these musicals, I think is enormously valuable. And what's happened is there's developed a kind of lingua franca, so that even though I don't speak Chinese, if I go to Shanghai and see The Lion King, I'll get it. Not only will I get it, but because I know the piece, I'll be able to see differences and I'll be able to understand how it's been Chinese-ized. And I think this tells us a great deal, one, about sort of the host culture, you know, the China, but it also tells us a lot about the United States, you know, and what do Chinese, how do they imagine the United States? So there's a lot going on in this.
So my next question is a bit, I have a tendency to ask this question, and I always feel like I'm like a dissertation committee when I do it. But you chaired many dissertations at CUNY Grad Center, so I feel like perhaps you'll grant me some grace. Can you talk to us about methodology and method for doing this kind of work? Because I feel like a lot of musical theater studies, and I say this not as an insult, a lot of it is focused on the text, right? Yes. For obvious reasons. And it's a great opportunity for musicologists and theater scholars and literature scholars and really, and myself, I hope, as a media studies scholar, to kind of come together and talk about musical theater. But it's also, it limits the kind of questions you can ask when you're only doing textual analysis. And your work, I think, models ways that we can apply other methods. So how are you thinking about how to study circulation beyond just looking at the text?
Well, I really feel that I have become an ethnomusicologist. And in many respects, my focus in the book is probably primarily on the music, song. It's also, to a large extent, on the spectacle and the performance. But of course, ethnomusicologists also deal centrally with performance. And I find that there are some musical theater scholars who come out of theater who don't really know music and don't understand, or at least don't write about, the different forms that musical theater uses, song forms. And this is something that I have studied now for decades and that is really important to me, so that when I listen to, say, a new Korean musical, you know, I can hear pretty, after one or two listenings, sort of what the form is. In other words, what are the conventions? What are the musical lyric conventions that they're playing with? And that, for me, has very much been at the heart of this project, because I don't speak much Korean, and my German is pretty good, but still, I mean, these are foreign cultures for me. But I find that going to see so many of these musicals, I understand them. And that, for me, has been one of the driving forces to understand, why do I understand? What is it doing? How is it communicating? What conventions, what language is it using? And of course, so much of this goes back to the music. Song form.
Yeah, it struck me, if I can just add a little anecdote for a moment here. I was living in New York last summer, and I got... I guess it was 2 summers ago now because it's closed, but I went to see Phantom because I got a cheap ticket and I was like, you know, let me go see this old war horse. Hey, and you know, the scholar in me, when we were in intermission, wanted to talk to the folks next to me and like, oh, you know, what'd you think? And I realized quite quickly that I couldn't, because they were not native English speakers, or they didn't speak English comfortably. Right. But they knew the show. Right. And scholars in musical theater studies have talked about this for some time, right? That the audience has become more international and more tourist focused, right? But this is so crucial to how the Broadway musical operates, that it resonates in these ways that we might not fully appreciate beyond just the story or just the production itself, right? That there is something else going on there.
Exactly.
Your book is also exploring kind of two separate but intersecting strains, right? These Broadway musicals that begin in the United States and kind of go abroad and get adapted into local and national contexts.
Right.
But also this other phenomenon of Broadway musicals, Broadway style musicals emerging from those contexts. So rather than originating in the United States, kind of originating in Korea or in Germany. So can you tell us more about the Broadway style musical and the centrality of this this framing for your study?
Well, what I'm really referring to with that is, again, a set of musical theatrical conventions, particular kinds of songs, song forms, generally sort of particular musical styles. I mean, when I'm talking about the Broadway style musical, I'm talking about basically American popular song that has traveled the world. I mean, I don't think that there is, in fact, I know there is no success story in terms of U.S. culture abroad, as with jazz and popular music, even film. And it has so permeated the entire world. And this really has become a kind of lingua franca, understanding that there are, I mean, yeah, it changes often radically from place to place, but still it allows for a certain level of comprehension. And this also for writers of music theater in Korea, in Germany, in Austria is also really important here, have sort of taken up this language because it's one they've known for decades and decades. I mean, one reason why I deal with South Korea and Germany is because they were both occupied by the United States after World War II and the Korean War. And they had the largest armed forces installation, U.S. armed forces installations in the world were in South Korea and Germany, which meant that there were armed forces radio broadcasting all over the country. There were clubs that needed local entertainers. And this really spread the conventions of U.S. popular music, jazz, rock, etc., so that so much of the work grows out of that history. And in that sense, it's very much a kind of legitimate form in these countries, because they've known this for decades.
Your teen requested a ride, but this time not from you. It's through their Uber teen account. You drive your teenager around a lot to their friend Jacob's house, their other friend Jake's house, to James's, to Jaden's, to Jalen's, to...
Mom, this is Jake's house, not Jacob's.
Now with an Uber teen account, your teen can request a ride under your supervision. They'll ride with a highly rated driver, and with live trip tracking, you'll follow along the whole ride to their friends' houses that all sound the same. Add your teen to your Uber account today. See app for details.
Bye, Mom.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
So one of the things I appreciate about this book is how you historicize this phenomenon, and you offer us an interesting case study of a musical I'd never heard of, but I was hoping you could tell us more about White Horse Inn and its kind of its place within these dynamics between the U.S. and Germany, culturally speaking.
Yeah, White Horse Inn is, I think, the most interesting example of international musical before World War II. It was first performed in Berlin in 1930. Most of the songs were by Ralph Benatzky, but a couple of other songwriters contributed. And it was directed by Eric Chorel, who was a very celebrated theater director in this huge, like 3,000 seat theater. And it became a huge sensation. This, of course, was only 2 years after Three Penny Opera, but this was a much more traditional operetta kind of musical. But on the other hand, Im Weißen Rüssel, as it's called in German, is also unmistakably a musical. I mean, yeah, it's an operetta, but it's also a musical. And the whole history of the musical in Germany is so intertwined with that of operetta. And Im Weißen Rüssel, White Horse Inn, is the clearest example of that. I mean, listening to the German recordings from 1930, it sounds like operetta. Now, it's after 1930, the musical traveled the world. It probably did about a dozen stops on, I think, three continents before finally landing in New York in 1936. It had very successful runs in both Paris and London in the early 1930s. And I've read the British version. And the British version, although the musical, it takes place in Austria and it's about tourists, and that dimension of it remains. But, and of course, in the German version, the tourists are from Berlin. In the British version, the tourists are from London. In the US version, the tourists are from Brooklyn. So it's, in other words, it's been localized in all of these countries. And when it came to New York, the Center Theater, in 1936, and it was actually the last German import to be performed in the U.S. before World War II. And it became hugely successful. The lyrics for this new version were written by Irving Caesar, who was a celebrated songwriter of the first half of the 20th century, who wrote, among other things, Key for Two. So it has a completely American feel to it. And you realize, oh, wait, White Horse Inn is not an operetta, it's a musical. And I can't think of another piece where there's quite the shape-shifting of this. You listen to the French recording and, oh, of course, this is it's like a French musical piece. So it's for me, it's a kind of chameleon and shows how eminently adaptable this form is.
So I fear you've set me up to ask you the million-dollar question, which is, what does musical mean for you, right? When you deem something a musical. And I know you talk about this at length in the book, but I'm wondering if for our listeners who are not in musical theater studies, obviously this is a slippery signifier, but I'm curious if you could offer us kind of a working definition, especially when you kind of put it up against operetta. I say this as someone who loves Candide, and yet every time I read something on Candide, the scholar can never decide whether or not to talk about it as an operetta or a musical.
And I too love Candide. And of course it's both. What is a musical? I'm very much coming at this study from a knowledge of canonical American musicals, really starting with Showboat, going into Rodgers and Hammerstein, the late Cole Porter musicals, and then in the 1960s, West Side Story in the 50s, which is so important. In the 1960s, Hello Dolly, Fiddler on the Roof, Hair, 1970s, A Chorus Line. And of course, Sondheim as well. So this is all part of the mix that to me, designates Broadway musical. And again, it's particular sets and conventions. The fact that in the musical uses particular kinds of songs, like, you know, I am songs and I want songs. That there are often, almost always, love duets. And one of the most important is the so-called 11 o'clock number, the big number, generally not the finale, but just before the finale. So all of these things tell me this is a musical. And I must say that my perception of this is very subjective, because there is certain work, I mean, some of the German work that I write about, is most people would not think of as musicals. But that's because the people, the Germans who would be going to see it, don't think anything of musicals. They think that musical theater is garbage, while this director is somebody who makes art. So it can't possibly be a musical as far as they're concerned. So that's one of the things I'm doing in this book, is challenging that German prejudice against musicals. And I'm saying, look, you know, look at this work that is also avant-gardist theater, but that at the same time is a musical, or at least uses musical theater conventions.
And that sets up my next question brilliantly. So thank you for that answer. One thing I appreciated about your book and your work in general is how it situates musical theater as always already art and commerce, right? That musical theater is a commodity. But there's also a clear effort here to push against the framing of such theater as Mick theater, the community musical, kitsch, right? Like, and I think that that's a really important distinction to make as scholars, right? To not just give into this armchair Adorno approach, right? Where it's just kind of like, oh, it's produced by an industry, it's dreck. So can you talk a bit about how you're pushing against that narrative and offering us a more nuanced approach to musical theater that acknowledges the circumstances of its production without dismissing it in the process?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a huge question. And I mean, I could talk for hours about this, but let me say that this is something I really, well, when I was in graduate school and when I was an assistant professor, it was unthinkable that you would study musicals. You never talked about musicals. It had nothing to do with what I was studying as theater. You know, Shakespeare and Racine and Molière and so on. And it was, and so for quite a while, I drunk the Kool-Aid and I thought, you know, this is just junk. Then in the 1970s, I started listening to Sondheim again. I thought, wait a minute. There's something really important that's happening here. And sort of between like 1976 or 77, the opening of Sweeney Todd, and the 1990s, and I thought, wait, this is some of the greatest theater there is. And so in the late 1990s, I wrote a essay called Middlebrow Anxiety that was about, you know, how musicals make people really uneasy because they're not easily classifiable. That is, if we are going to split the musical and theatrical worlds between sort of art music and popular, because musical theater basically is both and this is, I think, one reason why it has been uniquely successful. I mean, it's the only American theater form that really has traveled and continues to travel the world. But it's one that makes intellectuals still in the United States and certainly in Germany, you know, very nervous. And I was really taken aback by how dismissive German theater scholars and musicologists were and still are to musicals. So I really feel that one of my main missions the past 25 years has been to defend this form. You know, and frankly, at the heart of this as well, I think really is Black music. Because if we're talking about American popular music, at the heart of that are African-American traditions. And this is why American pop music has conquered the world. And so I don't want to suggest that in Germany that the prejudice against musicals has to do with racism, because I don't think that that's what it's about. But it is sort of a hangover, holdover from Adorno. And it's just astonishing to me, the sort of the way that Jarrell's sort of their very blithe dismissal of this, so much of this work, which is why it's been a pleasure to meet a few, to get to know a few Germans who really love it and appreciate it and write about
it. So I wonder if, while we're talking about the German context in particular, if we could talk about Rocky. And how Rocky kind of emerges from Germany and travels to Broadway, and how that's kind of representative of the trend that you're studying here.
Yeah, Rocky was actually one of the first musicals that really traveled from. It was the first to travel from Germany to the United States. Around 2000, Dance of the Vampires opened on Broadway, played probably like five performances, was totally panned, and was a notorious disaster. And that came originally from the anthem. But Rocky was an all-German production, except that the composer, lyricist, book writer, director, and designers were all American A-list creators. So it basically, Stage Entertainment, which is the sort of big musical corporation in Germany, produced it in Hamburg in 2012, really as a tryout for Broadway. The same way that Dreamgirls in Korea in 2008 was a tryout for a production that a couple of years later came to the United States. And granted, Hamburg is a lot further from New York than Boston or Philadelphia, but still, it's increasingly Europe and East Asia have become the places to try out new work. So Rocky was one of the first, and I went to see it in Hamburg, and I was a bit skeptical because the movie has never been one of my favorites, but I thought it was actually really charming and really sweet, and it was almost a intimate story with a spectacular ending. And Flaherty and Ahrens did the score, and it's a fairly old-fashioned kind of score for the most part. So I thought, okay, well, and then there were all of these ads on TV with Sylvester Stallone saying, yes, you know, we're setting this in Hamburg because Hamburg is a rocky city. And I was so interested sort of at how Philadelphia became transplanted to Hamburg. Anyway, so a couple of years, 2-3 years later, it finally appeared on Broadway at the Winter Garden, which is one of the largest Broadway theaters. The production, the scale of the production was so much larger, and it was marketed in a completely different way. It was basically marketed as like a sports musical, and sort of as a guy musical, as a date musical, which was most emphatically not the case in Germany, where it was, standard musical theater audience of families, really. So it did not do terribly well on Broadway for a number of reasons. And I just felt that the Broadway production was really overblown in so many ways, and that it really lost what, for me, was the heart of the piece, which is too bad. But this is also a measure of how difficult it can be to move these works. I mean, there are so many, there are a couple of Korean musicals that I've seen that I love, and I'd give anything to see them in New York, but there would just be too difficult to translate, to transport. So instead, we have to travel to see them. I do.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. ArmorAll, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I'm sure that's a burden for you to have to travel to Germany and Korea to see these works. But this is more of an aside, but something I'd be interested to learn more about, too. Do you have a sense of how Hamburg becomes this kind of center for, has it always been a center for theatrical production? Because you spend a good deal of time in Berlin, but it's really Hamburg that is the center of musical theater production in Germany and in Europe. It's a huge center for theatrical production, right?
Yeah, it's the largest in continental Europe, second only to London in Europe. Well, one thing to bear in mind is that theater in Germany is not centralized the way it is in the United States or the UK. And although Berlin has more theaters than the other major German cities, Hamburg, Munich, Frankfurt, Stuttgart, they're not necessarily better. In fact, most of the best work that I've seen this season in Germany has not been in Berlin. And this, I think, is one of the really exciting things about German theater is that it's not centralized. And the fact that over the breadth of the country, there are about 130 state-subsidized theaters. So theater is very thick on the ground. Now, in fact, Tomborg, I mentioned Stage Entertainment, which is a commercial enterprise. It's not state-subsidized. And why Hamburg? I mean, Hamburg has a long theatrical tradition, like all of the major German cities. I suspect, well, Stage Entertainment was formed by a Dutch entrepreneur, I think in the 1980s or in the 1980s. And of course, Hamburg is conveniently located in northern Germany, not far from the Netherlands, not far from Denmark. And Hamburg is a big tourist center. So I think that Stage Entertainment was really intent on taking advantage of its proximity, the fact that there were a lot of musicians who were already established in Hamburg. Also, Hamburg was being redeveloped in the 1980s and 90s, so it was possible to build new theaters for musicals. So there are a lot of factors went into this.
And we talked about these historical precedents with White Horse Inn, but it seems that a lot of what you're talking about in your book is largely a contemporary phenomenon, or at least one that has been energized in the 21st century. Can you talk a little bit about what shifts you're noticing globally and industrially in terms of how musical theater is produced that have made the Broadway-style musical all of a sudden have a greater currency right now?
That's really tough because there are so many actors in that.
Sorry.
I mean, I think part of it has to do with the fact that commercial theater everywhere in the world is really risky business. And a lot of commercial producers are basically diversifying. And one way to do so is to produce work abroad and to co-produce it. I mean, so many of these German and Korean productions are co-produced with local producers. So there is a lot more exchange on the international market. So there are a lot of international partnerships that are growing up. Another thing is that as cities all over the world, and this is, again, sort of we're talking here about globalization starting in the 90s, the 2000s, as so many cities are becoming or attempting to become world cities, one of the ways in which they prove that is by making musicals. And this is one reason why there really has been an explosion of musical theaters, both sort of Broadway and West End musicals, but also local musicals, you know, all over continental Europe, in São Paulo, in Rio, in Buenos Aires, in Dubai, in Johannesburg, in Budapest, and of course, Tokyo, Seoul, Shanghai. These are all major theater centers, tourist centers, and it's part of the tourist infrastructure, really, at this point.
I'm wondering, just as a follow-up to that, do you see these companies and these commercial endeavors coming from the same source as something like a really useful group or LiveEnt or Disney? Or do you think that they're kind of following the lead of those US, UK companies? I mean...
Well, I think they're following the lead.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, it really is a continuation of that. I do think that these corporations, such as Stage Entertainment, and the big Korean producers as well, are very attuned to local tastes, local history. I mean, it's really interesting that a lot of the musicals developed in Korea, in Germany, in Austria, are highly nationalist in terms of their content. When you have musicals like Mozart from Vienna and Elizabeth, which is about Empress Sisi, and so many Korean musicals about Korean history and culture. So I see this as part of the sort of tourist infrastructure and very much connected with nationalist missions in all of these countries to sort of spread the good word about Austria or Korea. It's advertising, among other things.
Yeah, your emphasis on nationalism, I mean, I feel like we could almost trace that all the way back to Wagner writing about the Gesamtkunstwerk, right? Because we can't separate his theorization there from his nationalism.
Yeah.
So I wanted to kind of pivot a little bit to the framework and the theoretical intervention you're making here, because one of the things that struck me too in reading your book is you're really pushing against the cultural imperialism thesis, right?
Yeah.
This idea that... America produces products and ships them around the world and forces these cultures to take in Coca-Cola and Disney and McDonald's. And I think you're offering us a way to kind of rethink that. That's less kind of top down, less kind of that offers more agency to those cultures and gives them more credit than we give them when we think in that way. Can you talk about that and particularly the usefulness of globalization as a concept for your work?
Yeah, I think this is enormously important. And I speak out strongly against the so-called McTheater thesis that I think is completely wrong. And it tends to be formulated in terms of musicals, sort of by people who don't really know musicals terribly well, and by people who have not really traveled to see this work. I mean, I've seen a huge amount of work outside the United States and the United Kingdom, and it's so clear to me how in some cases radically work is transformed, how it's localized, how it ties in with local histories, how there are local references. This is also complicated by questions of translation, the fact that this work has to be translated. And so how is that going to be accomplished? There was a very interesting piece in the Times a couple of years ago when Hamilton opened in Hamburg. And evidently the translation was done by an established musical theater translator and a German hip-hop singer. So... who actually, I didn't see it, but from what I understand, it was a fairly successful translation. But, you know, again, this is sort of part of that adaptation process. And I'm fascinated with how various cultures have made these musicals their own. I mean, to see West Side Story in Berlin, Barry Kosky's production from 2012, 2013. And the fact that what he did was basically globalize West Side Story, because it was no longer, I mean, yeah, the score was kept intact, but it was no longer Anglos and Puerto Ricans. It was, you know, one group of one gang versus another gang. And Barry Kosky talked about how he was inspired by this when he saw footage of the Arab Spring, and you know how difficult it was to tell sort of who was who and which side was which side. And I think that for me is a fascinating and really powerful example of a radical rethinking that at the same time is really simple. I mean, yeah, we have the Puerto Rican inspired music, and that is at the heart of the piece, but it doesn't have to be racialized or ethnicized the way that Bernstein and company planned it. Kosky was also given permission to do his own new choreography. And the choreography for it, there's a picture on the cover, is Dance of the Jam. And you can see very clearly from that is not Jerome Robbins. And it's a lot sexier. And anyway, so for me, that's a really fascinating example of how musical theater is globalized.
I mean, when I received a copy of your book, I thought the cover image was stunning. But I also thought, like, oh, is that from like Saturday Night Fever or Xanadu or something, you know, with all the disco balls and the, mm-hmm. you know, also, you know, the costuming, right? And it's fascinating to think about, you know, what is West Side Story when it's not in New York, you know, where an American audience has certain expectations, even seeing the Eva Von Hova production right before the pandemic shut it down, and seeing on the one hand him kind of pushing against those expectations, but certain things that he can't get away from, right? Because it's still West Side Story. So my next question is an immodest one. So I'm curious, what are some of the work you're seeing in the field and work that you're hoping you'll see in the field in light of this book? You know, what kind of questions and areas of inquiry are you hoping that this intervention opens up?
Well,
or continues, I should say.
Yeah. One of the most exciting and challenging parts of this project was to write about work, and this is specifically German work, that is not generally considered musicals. And most of my chapter 5 about the work of the director Herbert Fritsch, that's not traditionally considered musical theater. Fritsch is a farceur, and as far as I'm concerned, by far the most brilliant director of farce any place. And I really did not feel that I was shoehorning this work into that category, calling it musicals. I mean, some of the work, yeah, but the particular pieces that I write about, in fact, fit in very nicely. But one thing that I have discovered from living in Germany for a long time is that there is this wealth of theater, of music theater, that is being staged in, not in opera houses or in musical houses, but in theaters that specialize in spoken theater, Sprechtheater. And for me, this is right now what is most exciting, is to discover the new kinds of music theater that are being created in the German-speaking world in what are called Sprechtheater. And these are new kinds of theater. And this is, looking back to Wagner, sure, but also looking back to A Chorus Line, and looking back to West Side Story, but also to the avant-garde, looking back to Dada and to Surrealism and to the Futurists. And I just find in Germany that there is the most incredible sort of fusion work that is happening. Similar in Korea. For me, this is what is really exciting, is the creation, almost, I would say, of new genres of music theater that owe a good deal to the Broadway musical, but taken elsewhere. And for me, these really have been eye and ear opening. That's what I love most, and that's what I'm continuing to write about, to explore.
And that's my last question, which is, what are you thinking about now, and what are you reading and viewing? And
well, right now I'm I plan to write in a long essay about a German director and composer who have collaborated now, I think, on six pieces. And the director's name is Ulrich Rascha. The composer is Nico van Versch. Their work has not really been seen outside the German-speaking world. They're not known, like so many of the greatest German directors. And they're doing a kind of music theater that I think is revolutionary, at the same time that it looks back to ancient Greek theater. I mean, this is, in a sense, they are reinventing the ritual theater of ancient Greece, which is, of course, also what Wagner claimed he was doing. But I think that Rascha and Van Versch are doing it a lot better. So they do plays like Agamemnon and the Bacchae, a lot of Greek tragedy, but also some German tragedies, and Sarah Kane, and this new music theater, which is through composed, but without singing. In other words, it's sort of chanted, spoken. And another thing that makes this work remarkable is that the stage floor is always moving. They use either turntables or treadmills. So the actors are always moving, always dancing, always chanting, and there's the constant music. So this, for me, is a new music theater. And it's opera. I mean, basically, I'm going to be writing about it as opera without singing. This is what I love.
Wonderful. That sounds amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time today, David. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. The book is Tell It to the World, The Broadway Musical Abroad, available now from Oxford University Press and other online booksellers. This is Pete Kunze, and this has been New Books in Performing Arts on the New Books Network. Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us again next time.